Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It's a wonderful pleasure to welcome best-selling author and journalist Bruce Weber, who at age 57 took his second bicycle ride across America and chronicled it in the New York Times, where he worked as an obituary writer. And he took this diary of his road stories and turned it into the book Life is a Wheel, Love, Death, Etc., and a Bike Ride Across America. You are certain to enjoy this road trip memoir and contemplation of midlife, so please welcome Bruce Weber.
Thank you for the nice introduction, and thank everybody for coming out. You know, I'm kind of a newcomer to readings, and it's such a thrill to actually have people who seem to want to hear what I have to say. Life is a Wheel is a very personal book. It's written in diary form. As I rode my bike across the country in 2011, there's a certain amount of artifice in that. I didn't write it all while I was riding. And it's a book about cycling, but it's also a memoir, a very personal memoir. And I've been looking around. I've been kind of searching for a kind of easy way to describe what the book is and what it's about. And the best I've come up with is that it's a book that it's about the way we think about ourselves as we grow older. It's about the way we judge ourselves, and I use myself as a case history. So, which is why the book is so personal. Anyway, it's also a very self-conscious book. I'm aware that I'm writing about myself all the time that I'm writing about myself, and that's what the first section that I'm going to read. Is about. I've got three little sections that I'm going to read, and I know from my days as a theater critic, people like to know what the running time of the show is. So I'm thinking, I don't know, two and a half hours, maybe with a 10 minute intermission. Just kidding. Wednesday, July 20th, before dawn, Astoria, Oregon. I'm lying in bed as I write this, consciously watching my fingers on the wireless keyboard I bought to go with my iPad. It's not surprising that I can't sleep. In a couple of hours, I have to begin living up to all the bravado of my newspaper stories and begin riding a fucking bicycle across the United States. Despite Astoria's status as a bike mecca, there is no consensus on the best way to get out of town. U.S. Route 30, which follows the Columbia and heads toward Portland, accommodates bicycles, but it's a busy highway without a consistent shoulder. The bridge across the river to Washington is rideable, I'm told, but terrifying. It certainly looks terrifying from underneath, with minimal bike room, traffic that buzzes by at high speed, and the possibility of buffeting winds high above the water. So I've decided to go south, down U.S. 101, another heavily used road, though it is officially designated as part of the Oregon Coast Bike Route. It would be nice to get started without route anxiety, but oh well. Trying not to think about that, I'm thinking about writing instead. At this hour, anxiety looms wherever your mind goes, which is why I'm concentrating on my fingers as the words seem to squirt out of them onto the page. It's so weird, isn't it? Anybody who has ever written anything has had that sensation, I think. The feeling, whether you're writing with a pencil, a typewriter, or a computer, that between the time the thoughts are born in the brain and the time they escape from your fingertips onto the page and take coherent form, some kind of alchemy happens. How and where do those thoughts gestate? Do they swim through the bloodstream and take their nourishment? Are they fired to life as they are transferred from nerve ending to nerve ending? Is an idea, a thought, before there is language for it? And what is the role of your hands, really, in shaping the language? Writers know that in every mind there is a chamber, an awful, dark place where sentences retreat in order not to be written, a safe house where the perfect verb, the clever and poignant metaphor, the incontrovertibly brilliant coinage is always hiding, avoiding revelation. Often, as I watch myself typing, I imagine my hands reaching into that chamber and feeling around, straining, my fingers waving like tentacles, fishing desperately for the absolute best way to say what I want to say. Which brings me to my fingers specifically. As it happens, I was born with two missing from my right hand. This part of the reading comes with a visual aid. Granted, it's the kind of handicap that is not a handicap so much as a conversation starter. Fortunately, or maybe consequently, I'm left-handed. I can't play the piano or the clarinet. I use a baseball glove that would be well-suited to a little leaguer. My right arm is a little attenuated, so my overall strength isn't quite what I'd like. Pull-ups have always been a misery. And on all of my bicycles, I've had the rear brake, the controlling brake, switched to the left-hand side where my grip is better. Almost every time I use a borrowed bike, I forget about this, and during the ride, squeeze the left brake, making the front wheel seize and threaten to toss me over the handlebars. All that said, my right hand is an okay hand, a little small, but reasonably functional. Here it is again. I'm a better than adequate typist, for instance, hunt and peck variety. The hand is smooth in profile, not stumpy or ugly. I have a thumb, a middle finger, and a ring finger. And the overall shape is that of a talon. When I look at pictures of myself, I think my hand makes me look slightly off balance. Other people, though, tend not to see it at all unless we have occasion to shake hands, which I always do firmly, with conviction. Is this meant as a macho statement, a subconscious declaration? I'm as much as a man as you are, even though I only have eight fingers. Reasonable hypothesis. But then their faces tend to register briefly that something is amiss and they are seized by a conundrum of etiquette. Say something? Or just plunge forward, maybe with a stammer or a blush. Kids are better. They're curious, of course, and don't much bother with manners. Sometimes they think I'm pulling an adult prank on them, as if I've got a couple of fingers in my wallet that I'll screw back on in a minute or two. A few incidents, a handful, have been especially memorable. Once at work, a colleague introduced me to his 6-year-old son. We shook hands, and the kid freaked. "He's a monster!" the kid wailed, horrifying his father, who continued to apologize for days afterward until I got tired of trying to placate his guilt, and really, we could no longer be friends. That was a while ago, and as an event, it didn't mean much. I'm insecure about a lot of things, but not about my hand, though I had a therapist who thought otherwise. And I admit that in a lot of photos of me, my right hand is in my pocket. I've just noticed that recently. I attribute my general equanimity about it to a few childhood influences, among them a grandmother who knitted me 3-fingered gloves that would always be returned when I lost them, and a junior high school friend who cheerfully nicknamed me Claw and imitated the practice of greeting me with a particular handshake. 2 fingers extended and the ring finger and pinky folded against the palm, a ritual, like this, he used to shake hands with me, a ritual that among my remaining acquaintances from that time persists to this day. Anyway, a few years after the monster business, I was walking with a friend's 8-year-old child, and I took her hand as we crossed the street. On the other side, she didn't let go right away and instead was doing some exploring, feeling around a bit. After a moment or two, she stopped on the sidewalk. We were in a crowded neighborhood in Hermosa Beach, California, and placed her hands theatrically on her hips. 3 fingers, Sharon announced. "That's extraordinary." And repeated this phrase, or versions of it, maybe she just learned the word, several times as we proceeded down the street. Head swiveled. "That's just extraordinary," she declared. "Really extraordinary." It was funny. Her father and I grew hysterical, but the incident has stayed with me because the idea of what is ordinary, and by extension extraordinary, is interesting to me, and at this stage of my life, even a little bit profound. I wonder if missing fingers are relevant to character. Did my unusual hand, a physical feature I was born with, mark me in some way as distinctive? But then there is the grander, more general question. Am I an ordinary guy? I think I am. But is this something to be proud of or disappointed by? Another feeling everyone has had, I think, is of not fitting in, of being in a school or a group or an office, of being at a party or a dance or in a bar and being unable to make contact with other people, feeling left out, not knowing the secret password and being somehow excluded or cut off. like an unwanted runt from the herd. Part of the agony of this sensation, for me anyway, is the ambivalence that accrues to it, the absolute inability to decide whether you want in or whether you're better off on your own. If only these people would open up their ranks and accept me, you think, they'd discover I'm just like them. But is that what I want? They're also, I don't know, indistinguishable, and as a result, not very interesting. So maybe I'm better off just hanging out here, fending for myself, enjoying my own company, waiting for another opportunity in a place where I'll feel more at home, among other people, more extraordinary people, with whom I'd feel more ordinary. To put this another way, finding a context for yourself is one of life's great projects. And this brings me to my cross-country bike rides. Ample undertakings, to be sure, but hardly the sort of epic or frontier-crashing journeys that, by their Odysseus-like scope or Lindbergh-esque daring, are compelling by definition and make readers want to read about them. The origins of the modern bicycle date to the early 19th century, and people have been riding across the United States on them for more than a century, since the 1890s at least. Between 1894 and 1895, a Boston mother of three named Annie Cohen Kopchowski most likely became the first woman to cross the country on a bicycle. By now, hundreds, maybe thousands of people do it every year, and in fact, if you want to know more about them, there's a website called crazyoldguyonabike.com that serves as a forum for hundreds of bicycle diaries. The year after my first trip, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, David Lamb, wrote a book about his own cross-country ride as a middle-aged man, Over the Hills, he called it. Yuck, yuck. 18 years ago, after my first trip, I heard from dozens of people who congratulated me for completing a fine feat, but who wanted to let me know that their own trips were longer and faster and accomplished under much more difficult circumstances. This spring, on the cycling tour in Provence, during which Jen and I fell in love, one of our guides was a slender, banjo-paying Breton named Gwendal, who idolized Clint Eastwood and had a similarly wry, implacable demeanor. He had spent the previous winter, crossing Siberia on a bicycle in the snow, by himself. Siberia. Next February, Gwendal said he would go to Sweden. I asked him why. I think what I said was, why the fuck? I want to cross the Arctic Circle on a bicycle in winter, he said with a shrug. Over 3 weeks every July, the Tour de France guys race more than 2,000 miles through the Alps and the Pyrenees, often in gulps of more than 100 miles a day, averaging about 25 miles per hour. This kills me. And whether they're juicing or not, it's still amazing. An average of 25 miles per hour? Occasionally I get going that fast on a long downhill. It hasn't escaped me that as I begin my long, slow journey, this year's tour is coming to an end. But forget about them. Yuri Robich, heard of him? A soldier in the Slovenian army, he was the 5-time winner of something called the Race Across America, in which leading riders make it from sea to sea in less than 9 days. During one race, Robich set the world record for distance cycled in 24 hours, 518.7 miles. Now that's extraordinary. As it happened, last fall, Robich was careening downhill on a training ride near his home in Slovenia when he ran smack into an oncoming car and was killed. I wrote his obituary. In such company, my poor little rides don't bear mentioning, and yet, here I am mentioning them, writing about them at length, in fact, because in the context of men and women who wouldn't contemplate such a journey, they are arguably distinguishing feats. I didn't realize it at the time, but I can see now that, yes, my first transcontinental ride in 1993 was an act of some conceit, a bold project I conceived simply because I imagined I could do it and then wear it like a notch on my belt. I don't doubt for a second that I was partly or even wholly motivated by self-elevation, by wanting to feel extraordinary among my millions of ordinary peers. In my final piece for the Times about that ride, I wrote that there are two kinds of people, those who understand such a journey and those who don't. People who don't, I said, wanted to know why I would do such a thing, what the point was, their idea being that it was an immense effort in pursuit of an essentially intangible reward. After all, what would I get out of it but a sense of completion. I'd cross the George Washington Bridge, ride my bike to my apartment door, and, with great relief, stop riding. That being the case, one of my relatives said to me, I could just as well stay home and bang my head against the wall, and when I stopped, I'd feel the same thing. Of course, trying to explain the appeal to that relative and people like him was pretty much impossible. I actually said something like, well, it's fun. And that would generally make them shake their heads and go away. By the same token, for people who intuitively got it, there was no need to explain at all. They just thought it was cool or amazing or inspiring, and I never got tired of the admiring adjectives that people threw at me. This doesn't explain why I'd feel the need to do it again, of course. I'm not trying to reclaim past glory. I don't think so, anyway. That would be a glum errand. To experience again an exhilaration that I associate with youth, yes, that's part of it. But at this juncture, writing about the ride is just as important as taking it. Writing of any kind is, after all, an act of self-aggrandizement. Putting words on paper is a declaration. I have something to say. It's a louder declaration if you mean them to be published, and downright hubristic if you're writing in the first person. Listen here, I have something to say about myself. To try and do it well, to succeed at doing it well, that's what I would call extraordinary now. Well, you probably would like to hear something about actual bike riding. So this next short section is just after I've climbed over the Continental Divide in Montana, and I'm sort of facing the long flats. I don't think there's anything you need to know in advance of this, except maybe there's a... There's the mention of a guy named Scribner. I'm forgetting his name all of a sudden. Tom Scribner, who was a lawyer in Walla Walla, Washington, wrote to me while I was on the trip and invited me to stay at his house, which I did. And then he rode with me for a couple of days. And he was a very experienced rider, and he had ridden across Montana and gave me some advice, but. Anyway, that's more than you need to know. Sunday, August 14th, Cutbank, Montana. An hour before dusk, it's well over 80 degrees here on the prairie. I've been drinking liquids for about 4 hours, and it seems hard to believe that I was here once before on a journalistic assignment back in the 1980s on a January day when Cutbank registered the coldest temperature in the continental United States, 23 degrees below zero. No wonder nothing looks familiar. I'm in the flats of Montana now, and maybe 30 miles back, the Rockies finally disappeared behind me. I watched them go as I rode, looking back over my shoulder, stopping now and then and staring as they became smaller and smaller and finally shrank into the horizon. Happily, though, the kick of conquering the divide, the prolonged effort to reach the pass, and the breathtaking glide down the other side linger. I didn't describe much of the descent yesterday, but it was exciting. Tumbling mountain streams that spilled chutes of water over rock ledges, splendid and towering buttes of gleaming rock, and St. Mary Lake, deep and violet amid the peaks, majestic as an inland sea. I'm carrying yesterday with me, and the mountains, too, if I can't see them in the distance any longer, they're in perfect focus in my mind's eye. Cutbank, meanwhile, is a surprise after so many miles of Montana air and space, a legitimate town with banks and hardware stores and restaurants, houses with yards, people with daily schedules and responsibilities, an air of competence, and if not exactly prosperity, then pride and durability. It is, in other words, an island of sorts, a true prairie oasis. When you're in it, safely at home. Get to the edge of town, however, and you're surrounded by emptiness. The next thing in sight is the horizon. The sheer expanse of the continent has never been more evident to me than it has been just about all day today. I woke in St. Mary, a crossroads town just down the road from the east gate of Glacier. There was a beautiful view back into the park from the parking lot of my shabby motel, and just as the sun came up, I said goodbye to the six men I'd met the day before. Professional men, all of them longtime friends from Idaho and Montana, on a week-long cycling vacation, All were older than I by a decade or more, We'd ridden over the Continental Divide together, or rather, they'd all passed me on the way up, and I'd followed them down. We had reservations at the same motel, it turned out, and last night we celebrated our achievement at dinner at a restaurant in a roadside log cabin that has been there evidently for more than 60 years. Johnson's Cafe, or as it says on the website, Johnson's world-famous historic restaurant, is a family-style place, obviously a local landmark, and as we gobbled down huge platters of pork chops, fried chicken and steak, and the biggest slices of ice cream cake I've ever seen, I thought they were as big as Rhode Island. It was a meal to match the day. I was stuffed. This morning, my new friends were headed south. North into Canada. I was going south and east. Though I'd made it over the divide, I wasn't done climbing, and from St. Mary I rode once again up, straight up it seemed, about maybe 5 miles through a forest landscape that had been devastated by fire not so long ago. I ascended for well over an hour. The views back toward Glacier were eerie, striking, and I stopped two or three times to appreciate them. The broad and majestic stony peaks rising behind a vast meadow of ruined trees reduced to ash-colored upright needles. It was a brilliant day. At the top of the climb was a rounded hilltop that seemed strangely empty and lunar, aside from the billboard advertising a restaurant called Two Dog Flats. The road was wide, as if some sort of rush hour were to be expected, but this seemed unlikely. And as I crested the hill and looked east, I saw that the plateau of land I was on ended abruptly and plunged. And the road, it's U.S. 89, by the way, followed it down. There was simply a drop-off. And behind it, in the distance, the whole rest of the nation seemed to be spread out before me like a vast table that was waiting for place settings. I was amazed. Really, this must be where someone coined the phrase, "It's all downhill from here." If only. In fact, there were some uncomfortable ups and downs before I finally hit the flats. The road pointed south for several miles with a number of twists in it, no big help against the stubborn wind from the southwest. But I finally found myself heading due east toward Browning on Star School Road, a desktop straight thoroughfare for pickup trucks with little weather shelter, and was able to use the wind a bit to my advantage. It wasn't quite a sailboat ride into town, but it was good to feel like the gods were at least a little on my side. I was planning to stop in Browning for an hour or two at least, overnight maybe. But at the end of Star School, I turned south into town and someone riding in a pickup truck that was pulling out of a nearby gas station tossed a bottle out the back and it smashed on the road about 20 yards away with the sound of a gunshot. I'm not convinced the bottle was aimed at me. I'm not even sure the guy saw me, but yeah, it was spooky. And I was also being persuaded out of town by what I saw. The road went along the edge of town and didn't show the place off to much advantage. Auto body shops, unattractive housing developments, storage sheds, scrubby fields with litter blowing across them like tumbleweed. Besides, the wind had picked up and the road had turned into it, and I could tell by the map if I made it beyond town, I'd find the junction of Route 2 heading east and somewhat easier pedaling. So I passed on through, though not without difficulty. Just south of town, Browning ends abruptly, and so does civilization, and so does anything resembling a crest of land or a grove of trees. Really, it's just two flat plains out there, the sky and the prairie meeting at the horizon with a stripe of road slashing through the blankscape like the lone brushstroke on a minimalist canvas. I had a lingering flash of terrifying awareness, a sudden bolt of panic, and then a gradual increase on top of it. Of just how little protection from the elements is available to a cyclist on the high plains, and just how vulnerable I was going to be for the next several hundred miles. The first mile marker I remember passing on Route 2 said 422, meaning it was 422 miles to the North Dakota border. This may be a good time for a disquisition on the wind, which is naturally a huge factor on a trip like this, a thrilling friend when it's behind you, a wily foe otherwise, which feels like most of the time. I actually did almost call this book, "The Wind is My Enemy." The psychological battle between a cross-country cyclist and the wind is more complicated than you would think. First of all, the wind isn't a singular force, but a plethora of little forces that coalesce into a prevailing notion, though not without a number of contrary opinions. In other words, the wind is a million winds, most of them working more or less in concert, but many not, so that no matter which direction is prevalent, you're being buffeted by a battalion of little dervishes. think of a car being tugged through an automatic car wash with all the spritzing and polishing that goes on in there. West to east is the direction of the prevailing wind, though all that ostensibly means is it blows that way more often than east to west, and I'm not sure how significant that is given the number of days I've already had on this trip with winds from the south. It's true that riding east you rarely face a straight-on headwind, but it's also true that it doesn't line up 100% behind you very often either. Rather, most days it's a question of angles. A steady breeze or a gust coming at you from one side or the other, or hitting one shoulder or another, a slight, or maybe not so slight, deflection from your purposeful path. It's a bit like being nudged by a bully, again and again, frustrating at the least, disheartening at the most. Plus, crosswinds and headwinds are noisy. Passing through the slots in your helmet, rushing past your ears, they become a kind of tinnitus, blotting out bird calls and insect songs and obscuring the delightful quietude of country roads. They also make cars and trucks coming up from behind you hard to hear. What you hope for, what I hope for anyway, is semi-stillness, motion in the air, but nothing that feels like a force to contend with. You don't want stagnant air that feels stifling and soggy, and a gentle cool breeze is surely a boon to anyone who is exerting himself over an extended period. This afternoon I had a fairly accommodating wind, though I've discovered that on the prairie, rogue gusts are hardly uncommon, coming from anywhere at any time. And when a car, or worse, a truck goes rumbling by in one direction or another, the whooshing rush of air that comes with it combines unpredictably with whatever nature has going on at the moment and can make it seem as though a helicopter is alighting nearby, leaving you desperately gripping your handlebars and envisioning Margaret Hamilton, the Wicked Witch of the West, pedaling through this tornado in The Wizard of Oz. That's the image I conjured up about an hour or so beyond Browning when I encountered a cyclist going the other way. He stopped only briefly to say hello because, he said, he intended to make it to Glacier Park that night, 60 miles or so from where we were, and he was bravely contending with a wind that was clearly more problematic for him than for me. As I watched him pedal off, he seemed to be working much harder than I had been and making slower progress. This was when the musical theme for The Wicked Witch passed through my head, and I didn't know whether to pity him for the miserable afternoon he was looking at or admire him for having made it this far across the plains already. I didn't know where he had started, but given where we were standing, it had to be a long way away. In any case, I was glad not to be in his toe clips. From Browning, I progressed through the empty landscape for 35 or 40 miles, accommodating myself to a road I'll be living on perhaps for weeks. I know I've described it as a tabletop, and taking it in as a panorama, that's the impression you get, but it isn't exactly flat. Rather, like the ocean, over the long haul, it's vast and uninterrupted, but full of swells. The sort of gradual inclines and swoops that only cyclists and sailors notice, that don't make you strain but make you work. On my 1993 ride, I was farther south, traversing a hillier, more varied part of Montana between Livingston and Billings, and down through Little Bighorn. Between Livingston and Billings and down through Little Bighorn, followed by a dip into northern Wyoming. And I never had a stretch like this, facing days on end of prairie riding, chasing an ever-retreating horizon. The closest I came were the 2 days it took to cross the bleached ranch land of eastern South Dakota from Pierre to Grand Forks on the Minnesota border. Tom Scribner had warned me that the landscape of the Montana plains would be maddening, that after not too long, 20 or 30 miles, I'd begin to hunger for something new to look at or a different set of conditions to ride in and to despair that such a thing was so far off. About halfway to Cutbank, I discovered he was right. It isn't boredom exactly, but a blurring of focus. The pedaling you do when the terrain changes underneath you is natural as a heartbeat. You do it without thinking. But when the road and roadside go by beneath you and beside you with mile after mile uniformity, you grow self-conscious, and I began watching my knees pumping up and down and counting my pedal strokes. How far do I get in 100 revolutions? How many strokes to a mile? How many until I let myself rest and ease the perpetual soreness in my tush? This is a way of passing time, of course, of not being where I am until I'm somewhere else, and that's not how I want to ride. I'll have to figure out something. Just before Cutbank, there's a brief respite from the sameness as the road plunges into a river gorge and clamors out again. So when you get there, it feels as though you've ascended to a hilltop aerie. It was welcome, even though I was beat, and climbing to end the day isn't what I ever wish for. I rode completely through town and took a motel room on the far eastern end, just where Main Street heads off to join US 2 and spills the, sorry, to rejoin US 2 and spills the refreshed traveler back onto the endless pancake of prairie. I ate an early dinner at a nearby steakhouse. My entree's family probably lived around here, and then took a brief walk past my motel to the highway entrance. The sun was still an hour or so from going down, but the moon was already up, night chasing day, and I had the humbling thought that time itself, passing so quickly, was making fun of my progress. It was quiet and beautiful in a lonely way. I hadn't noticed while I was riding, but standing still I did. The wind actually whistles out here. Now I have one shorter and slightly more lighthearted section, and then I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. I said earlier that this is a very personal book, and what I'm about to read comes after a long section about a complicated relationship I had with my father. Anyway, you'll see. My father's funeral, on a warm day in June, 2.5 years after my mother's, was held in the same funeral home in White Plains as my mother's, in the same morose room with the stifling low ceiling, the same funeral director with the same well-practiced mien, somber and solicitous both, welcomed many of the same attendees. My brother, Robert, and I both spoke, as we did at our mother's, after the same rabbi, who had never met either of them, said pretty much the same thing he'd said the last time. It was all perfectly awful, sad and enervating, and when it was over at last, I whispered to my brother, "Good thing we're out of parents. I can't do this again." He looked at me with a little bit of shock before he recognized the mordant joke, and then he smiled disapprovingly. Robert, who is 4 years younger than I am, is a friendly, optimistic, responsible guy, and there's not an ounce of savagery in him, no bitterness the way there is in me. It was in both my parents, too. He's lucky that way, though one result is that Robert is missing the sense of grim humor I shared with our folks. In the grand scheme of our DNA, it's not much, a tiny nugget of the family sensibility, but I remember thinking as we buried our father and slid him into his mausoleum drawer that he would have understood me instantly and given my remark the appreciative smirk it was meant to elicit. My dad could tell a joke. Well, he used to be able to before he got really crabby and had a hard time seeing beyond himself. When he was younger, I admired his ability. He knew how to order the details and dole them out, emphasizing this one, casually letting that one escape. He liked shaggy dog stories. The longer and sillier, the better. Stories he could extend and embellish, building to a punchline that would make everybody groan. There was one about a couple of Italian brothers and two horses they inherited from their father but couldn't tell apart. I won't bother you with that one. But the one I especially remember, he told me when I was a young man, and he was maybe the age I am now. It was already an old joke then, I'm sure. At the time, I understood it, but I didn't get it the way I do now. Of course, it's about a man in the midst of a midlife crisis. He's got what seems on the surface to be an admirable, successful, rewarding, and happy life. He works on Wall Street and makes a lot of money, lives in a great house. Drives a nice car, a couple of nice cars. He's got friends. He plays a good game of golf. He loves his wife. He loves his kids. Everyone is well-adjusted. But his midlife crises do. It has overtaken his sense of well-being and made him feel that everything he has adds up to a big nothing. Driven to despair, he can't fend off the need to strike out on a quest. So he bids his wife and family a difficult but determined farewell and sets off on a trip around the world. He takes an ocean liner across the Atlantic and a train across Europe. He hitchhikes through Turkey and the Middle East and rides a camel across India. At last, he finds himself at the foot of the Himalayas, where he engages a team of Sherpas for the ascent to the cave of the mystical holy man who, it is said, holds the secret of existence. Up they climb. It takes days. The temperature dives, the wind howls, and the snow becomes deeper and deeper. The Sherpas keep asking the man if he wants to turn back, but driven by his desperate thirst for the ultimate knowledge, he persists. Finally, exhausted but thrilled, he arrives at the holy man's cage and crawls in for his audience. And there he is, wearing robes and a long beard, sitting cross-legged before a fire. Our hero is so cold, so tired, he cannot speak, but the holy man offers him a bowl of celestial nectar, and the man drinks gratefully and finds himself miraculously restored. "Your Holiness," he says, "I have come such a long way to see you. I left everything I knew behind, my wife and family, my home, my work. I took an ocean liner across the Atlantic, a train across Europe, cars across the Middle East, and a camel across India. I've been climbing these mountains for the past 10 days, and all because I want to ask you a single question." "Of course, my son," the holy man says, "what is your question?" "Your Holiness, what is the meaning of life?" The holy man leans back a bit and takes a deep breath. A beatific smile lights up his face. "Listen carefully, my son. Life is a wheel," he says, and falls silent. The man waits for more, but nothing more is forthcoming.
"That's it?" the man says. "Life is a wheel?"
"Yes, my son. Life is a wheel." Our hero is suddenly incredulous, and his despair bursts out of him in a flood of exasperated words. As he speaks, he gets more and more excited, and the volume rises. When he finishes, his chest is heaving and his face aflame with passion.
"Life is a wheel?" he says. "That's the secret? Life is a wheel? I leave my wife and family and 500 grand a year. I cross the Atlantic on a slow boat, ride a cramped and crowded train across Europe, hitchhike through that miserable desert, ride a camel, for Christ's sake, through India, and freeze my ass off, climbing all the way up here to ask you the question at the heart of my existence, and that's all you've got to say to me? That life is a fucking wheel?" At which point the holy man looks quizzically across the fire at his supplicant, his eyebrows knit in perplexity. "Life isn't a wheel," he says.
Now, if I haven't answered all your questions about everything, I'm happy to take any questions about the book, about my father and his terrible jokes, my obituary writing, anything. Or if not, I'm just happy to sign books. Yes. I'm sorry?
On your second.
On the second trip, I gave myself the advantage of a custom-made bike. On the first trip across, I just bought a regular old road bike, and it fell apart a couple of times. And this time I thought, you know, I don't own a car. I think I'll spend my car money on a bike. And I did. So it was a custom-made frame, titanium frame, and with nice components. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll own it for the rest of my life. Yes?
What does an obituary writer do if no one dies?
Well, it never happens. I mean, what do I... Well, one of the, you know, this is one of the, when people ask me, what's it like being an obituary writer? And I say, well, we are very unusual at the newspaper for many reasons, but one of them is that we never have to come up with story ideas. Yes? Well, it was actually a very interesting part. The first time in 1993, when I went across the country, I wrote about it for the Times as well. But I would write my story. I wrote about once a week, and I wrote my stories in a notebook in longhand and phoned them in to the newspaper, to something called the recording room. Somebody would answer the phone, and I would tell them who I was, and they'd say, "Okay, hang on a second." And press the button on a tape recorder, and I'd read the stories into the phone, and somebody would transcribe them and give them to an editor. This time, obviously, I didn't have to do that, and I was blogging, and there was an enormous amount of traffic. I mean, people were writing to me all the time. Most people telling me, "Great, you know, go great guns. We love the trip. You know, we're following you." Wishing me encouragement, and with a number of people who were, I've quoted several of them in the book, people who just disapproved of the whole enterprise or thought, you know, that I spent too much money on my bicycle, I'd gotten ripped off, I did, you know, you're, one guy wrote, "You're a total Fred." I don't even know what that means, but, you know. The other interesting story about technology is that in 1993 on the first trip, it was back in the day when television was the leading technology of the day. And I was riding across the country and basically, you know, completely in the dark about who was reading the stories, if anybody was reacting to them, if there was anything going on. When I got back to New York, there was a stack of letters on my desk. I'd never written anything that had gotten that reaction, but I had no idea that this was the case. But when I got to South Dakota on that particular trip, I was on the phone with an editor, and they said, you know, we got a phone call from the Today Show. They want to do a – I'd written a number of stories. They want to send a crew out to film you. I said, all right, great. So they sent a crew out to meet me in Rapid City, South Dakota, and we rode across the Badlands together one day. And then the crew, you know, it was a weird experience. They had the cameraman leaning out of a van all day long, taking pictures of my feet going around and around. But they left. And then 3 weeks later, after they had produced the piece, they arranged again to meet me on the side of the road, and I did a live interview with Katie Couric. She could see me, I couldn't see her. So the interview was over, the guy packs up the camera and the microphone, and he takes off, and I get on my bike and ride down the road. Within 5 minutes, a station wagon pulls up alongside me. Across the side of the road, this woman leaps out of the driver's seat, runs around the car, and yanks this poor 10-year-old kid out of the other seat and runs over to me and says, "Can I take your picture with my kid?" I said, "Sure." She takes a picture. She gets in the car and goes off. And about 20 minutes later, I decide to stop in a small town for breakfast. And I walk into this diner, you know, carrying my bicycle helmet, and everybody stood up and started applauding. So it was really really quite the illustration of the difference between the power of newspapers and the power of television at that particular time. Now, of course, it's all about it's all about interactive media. So that was a really big difference. Yes.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask you one other question, and it's unrelated. I've spent my life in newspapers, mm-hmm. and I've known who you are for years. I wanted to ask you why you brand yourself now as an obit writer when you've done so many wonderful things at the paper.
Well,
I think that maybe the crowd would be a little interested in hearing what else you've done.
Well, I'm happy to tell you. It's very, you know, it's a very flattering question. So, thank you. You know, when I was, I spent a good deal of my time at the paper writing about the theater. I was an arts reporter for a long time and a theater critic for several years. And when I would speak, when I was doing that, I would brand myself a theater critic, and people seemed to be really interested in that. But I have now been writing obituaries for six years, and it's my full-time job. And and I think in a lot of ways, it's as compelling to, and it's, you know, it's a macabre job. I mean, let's face it; it's an unusual job, and I think that there's, let me come clean a little bit. One of the reasons I do it is because I think it's appropriate to the theme of the book that I'm writing. So, a theater critic rides across the country is not quite the same. It somehow doesn't have the same resonance, you know. Anybody else? Oh, yes, sir.
How did you train to become an obit writer?
I go to the gym every morning. That's a kind of a macabre question, if you really want to know. I'm not sure you train to be an. I think one of the ways you get to be an obituary writer is that you get to be a certain age. There are five full-time obit writers at the Times and three full-time editors. And if you take our average age, they are so far, they're so much higher than the average age of any other department at the paper. And that's I don't know that it's by design, but I think that it's important because it helps actually writing obituaries if you've actually lived through some of the time that the people you're writing about have lived through. favorite obituaries. Well, you know, there were some eccentrics. I mean, the guy who owned the most famous typewriter repair shop in Manhattan, you know, Marilyn Chambers, the porn star who was also the Ivory Snow girl, and then there were the ones that are. A recent one was Ralph Kiner. Who was, you know, a great ball player and a great old announcer for the Mets. And then there are the tragic ones, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman and David Foster Wallace. In many ways, the ones that are the most fun to write are the ones that we write of the people who are still alive. Because we do a lot of those, you know, we do a lot of obits in advance. People who are, who have really accomplished lives and who we don't want to be, you know, it would take you just couldn't write a fully researched and fully thought through obituary, an accounting of that life in a day. So we do a lot of those. We've got a big, you know, it's... This will sound, I mean, a little obituaries desk humor. We have a file called "Circling the Drain," and the people who we hear about who are not in good shape, and we usually get somebody working on one of those on one of those obits. So. Well, listen, thank you, everybody. This was really nice of you to come out. I appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.